And my guest is James Coburn, who is here tonight, not really to plug anything, but to talk about a project he has in the works, a miniseries about the world as seen through a pagan woman in King Arthur's court, and about a new film that he'll be appearing in France. I'm very flattered that you're here tonight, because I know you don't do this very often. I love the commercial where the lady on the plane said, "Okay, Jimbo."
Yeah, she was wonderful, wasn't she?
Wonderful? Yeah, well, you're pretty wonderful, too. What have you been doing lately?
Well, I've been doing a lot of voiceovers. I've been working really hard. I've got a little production company called Tango. We're at Viacom, and we're putting together movies of the week and so on. We had this miniseries we've been working on for 3 years now. It's a book by Marion Zimmer Bradley called The Mists of Avalon. Hmm? Rita Mae Brown did the screenplay for it, and it's 4 hours, and it's a great story. It's about those ladies in King Arthur's time that I never knew anything about. You know, the Lady of the Lake and Morgan Le Fay. They seem to be kind of demonic in strange ways. They appear, and yet I never knew who they were.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what this book is about, is who they are. They're priestesses, and they live on the island of Avalon, and they're trained as in a way of pagan priestesses. They practice the mother goddess is their highest.
Now, considering what's happened to television in prime time, you would think that if a man with the stature of James Coburn came in and said, "Hey, I've got goddesses, I've got priestesses, I've got pagans, and beautiful women," somebody would say, "Let's get this thing going immediately."
Exactly. You would think that.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, there has to be so many people that say yes that down the line, you know, there's always one guy that says no.
No.
And all you need is one no in the thing. And, you know, it started at Showtime. Showtime actually paid for the script, paid for half of it. Our partner in London, Harlech Television, paid for the other half. And Showtime said, when we had it finished, he said, it's really not our kind of thing. We can't really afford to do this thing. And it's about a $9 million project, which that's not too big for television.
No, it's not.
We have most of the financing from Europe now. We have partners.
Well, considering that the war in remembrance, you know, that ran on ABC, what was that, $32 million such number? That was a big number. $9 million is not that bad. I mean, it sounds big to the average Joe, but you get commercials and you get that all back and more.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that isn't the problem. It's getting the people who are constantly changing on these upper levels in television.
Right.
And you get somebody on your side, and then all of a sudden they're someplace else. They're no longer there, and if they've made a deal with you, they we can't really do that. We'd like to do something else. But this is a great story, and we're going to get it made. I mean, I don't care.
Sure you will.
If we have to just make it all in Europe and all financed in Europe, that'll mean a European production, which is really what it should be anyway. But I'd like to have a good network. ABC has actually shown some interest in it.
Mm-hmm.
A man over there named Ellen Sabinson, who is currently in charge of miniseries and movies of the week, helped develop it, actually, when he was at Showtime.
So how did you ever get involved with this project? I mean, you've done so many things, James. You've been in, I mentioned, a lot of movies, and In Like Flint, that was a big thing for you. And then the beverage commercials, and how did you ever get involved with producing a miniseries?
Well,
there's so many other ways you can make a buck, young man.
Oh, yes. No, but it wasn't a question of making a buck so much. It was a question of fulfilling an obligation that I have to myself and to all the people that have, I guess you wouldn't call them fans. I guess maybe fans. But they put me in a position where I feel it's necessary to pay it back a little bit. Now, I've made enough money making films and so on that's not really the important issue. It's the important issue is to do something and to make a film, to make a miniseries, which is one of the really great forums. You can do so much
sure.
in 4 hours. You can tell a great story in 4 hours, 6 hours, 10 hours. That long form is just a really great forum to work in. Everybody likes to work in
that. And especially the kind of a story you're talking about, I mean, everybody can get involved with that kind of fantasy, if you will, okay?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and then learn the other side of things. But the reason I got involved with it is my lady brought this book to me, and she says, we should do this as a miniseries. And we just formed our company,
mm-hmm.
called Tango. And I said, yeah, we should. We read it, and it was great. It was all this other side of
sure.
of King Arthur that I didn't know anything about. And I thought, this is going to be an easy sell. Well, I mean, nothing is easy in this town, as you know. And so we picked up the rights, and we've been developing it. We've developed it for 3 years, 4 years. We're going into the fourth year right now. And it's the closest that it's ever been. I mean, it's just down the line. I mean,
terrific,
just
terrific.
Have to string these last few pearls together.
Okay,
and then
you got the necklace. Okay,
yeah, we've got it. And it'll be a wonderful piece. I'm proud of the piece itself so far. It's great.
You know, after the great success of Flint and some of the other motion pictures that you did, you became almost a mystery man. I think the only thing you did for a couple of years was the commercial for the beverage. And I remember there were stories in newspapers and the trade papers that the only thing James Coburn is going to do all year is say Schlitz Light. Remember that?
Yeah, I made the Guinness World Book of World Records, I guess, and with that for making the most money for saying the least amount of words.
I think it was $500,000 a word.
Yeah, that was funny. That was it was one of those things, you know. I never intended to do that, really, because I made it such an outlandish request. I said, okay, I'm not going to say my name. I have to play a character, and I'll only say the name of the product. And they came back with this idea. You're a guy who comes through the door, and everybody looks at you, and all you do is say Schlitz Light. I mean, the commercials were better than the beer, unfortunately. We had great initial sales, and then everybody started drinking this stuff, and it was really bad. And so they decided, well, let's change the commercials because we're not. But that did a great experience. I
think it's terrific, though. Yeah. And I'm sure you must have sat at home at night and said to your lady and everybody else who would listen, can you believe what goes on here?
Oh, God, it's really funny.
You know, there's a story that when the late Bill Kintner, who ran NBC, was after Dean Martin to do a television show back in the early 60s for NBC because Dean had all that success with Jerry Lewis. And Martin had made a lot of money in the movies and really didn't need to get involved with NBC. And he said to his agent, whoever it was, ask him for X. And I guess it was so outlandish that he figured this will absolutely stop all the nagging. They said, okay, if that's what Dean wants, we'll give it to him. And that's how the Dean Martin Show got started.
Right.
And I'm sure it's happened a lot of times.
Oh, yeah, he's probably still collecting on that, right?
Yeah, he certainly is.
Yeah.
But I think it's neat to say, I'm not going to do this. I'll say the name of the product, and I want X. And they said, okay,
we'll do it.
We'll go for that. We will continue with James Coburn and talk about this new film process. We are back with James Coburn. I'm sorry that you can't see this here. You have to go to Metz, France in May. And it's something called ShowScan. It's a new movie process. How does it work? I know you're not a technical guy, but...
Well, the process is a 70-millimeter, 60-65 frames a second going through this enormous machine. It's really a high-fidelity motion picture. It's on the screen size at Metz will be 65 by 40. An enormous size, but it's so real.
I know, because the screen swallows you up and you have peripheral vision and 3D effects and super stereo sound.
Oh, yeah, it's all of those things, but there are two or three processes that I've heard about. This Cinemax, I think it is, the one that it's at.
There's one going on at the Smithsonian. They have it also at Chicago Science and Industry. And then they have it at Disneyland.
Disneyland, that process. That's a...
What's the Captain EO, the Michael Jackson thing?
Yeah, I think so. Uh-huh. It's a little different process than this one. That's more conventional, I think. This one was developed by Doug Trumbull, who did he was the special special photographic effects artist that designed all of the Stanley Kubrick's
films
for 2001, the original one. And he made all of these machines, and he's developed this ShowScan process. Well, it's a hard process to work in because it takes up so much. You have 12-minute reels, and to learn to work in 12-minute reels, I mean, you have to,
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. I have
to learn a lot of lines because we're used to doing it over shoulder. You do 3 and 4 minute takes, and that's it. But to do a 12-minute take requires a different kind of technique. It's more almost a stage technique that's necessary. Come in, it's not even like television because it's so big. You're walking across this stage that's as big as a stage. And the special effects are so real. It's like you're watching a hologram. It's all taking place. In fact, there is a hologram in this, the one we did. It's like you're standing there, you're viewing all of this, and it's taking place right in front of you. It's that high fidelity. I don't know what more I can tell you about it. Except
you can tell me why it's playing in Metz, France, and not at the Epcot Center or Disneyland.
Because the people from Metz, France paid for it.
That would be a pretty good reason, wouldn't it? Yeah.
But it's going to go. It'll go to a place in Tokyo too, at a theme park there, and probably another in Canada. Maybe there's one in Canada as well. If they'll eventually share the cost of the thing. It didn't cost that much.
It's a good answer, though. They paid for it. That's how come they get to show it.
That's how come they get to show it. It's opening. I mean, the theme park itself is opening at that time, I guess, outside of Metz. They've invited us over. I don't know where they will go. Maybe we'll go. I'd like to see it. I'd like to see it, actually, on that big screen. I've only seen it on the smaller screen that we worked on out at MGM where we shot it.
How long has it been since you've made a feature-length film?
It's been about 4 years. The last time I worked on a feature-length film was in Australia. We did a thing called The Death of a Soldier. It was a true story that we shot down there. Before that, I don't know. See, I had arthritis for a while so badly I couldn't even walk.
Oh, you're kidding. See, I didn't know that. I didn't know you had that.
Yeah, for about 2 years, I was almost a cripple.
I just thought, along with a lot of us, that you really became a mystery man by choice, that you, you know.
No, it wasn't by choice. It was by sickness.
Okay, I didn't know that. I thought, James saved his money and said, hey, I don't want the rat race anymore, and went to the beach to, paint the
divorce,
books.
The divorce took all the money away.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is.
How fast it goes.
Oh, boy, yeah. And you have to start all over again. It becomes a whole new adventure. I mean, that's a very interesting trip, I must say. But thank God I don't have to do that again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, marriage is out for a while, for the rest of my life.
Do you really mean that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, see, I'm divorced, too, and have been for a long time. And it's okay. I don't begrudge the money. I mean, I didn't give like you had to give because I haven't earned like you've had to earn. But, I paid a lot.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know.
It's all relative.
What's the difference?
That's right.
Exactly.
How much do you need?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I discovered that. But in the
house. Did you now?
Sure, absolutely. Sure, and I'm living my life now, and I'm very happy. And I'm working. I'm working on another level, both inside and outside, to maintain that balance. I'm learning to live my life. I've been giving that more attention than just pure work, which was what I did for 20 years, was nothing but work. And,
And how many great cigars can you collect, Grant?
That's right. Right. Davidoff is the only one that seems to be still making them. Monte Cristo's.
We're with James Coburn back in just a couple of seconds and eventually joined by all of you on the radio show for Tuesday night. We'll be back after these words from our radio stations all across North America. You're from Nebraska, but your family moved here early on, didn't they? Like when you were 5 or 6 years old?
Yeah, when I was five. I had my fifth birthday in California. We lived in Compton. I grew up in Compton, went to school in Compton, and graduated from junior college in Compton. Then I went into the Army, and then went back to school to Los Angeles City College, went back to New York, and...
But what was your job in the Army? What'd you do?
I was a radio man, radio operator. I was in the 14th Armored Field Artillery, the service battery of that battalion, and of the 2nd Armored Division in Germany during the Korean War. They sent us over there to keep the Russians out of Western Europe.
And I might say that during James Colburn's tour of duty,
there were
not one Russian, right?
No Russians in Western Europe, by golly.
And so then as radio operator, you just were like an engineering type person?
You didn't have to do anything.
I got you.
We were in an artillery battalion, armored field artillery. We would call up coordinates. We'd go up and set up on a hill, and we'd get coordinates from, and we'd relay them down to the batteries. That was during firing practice. That was all we did. And the rest of the time, when we were on a bivouac, we'd bivouac out, and we'd have to find places to stay. And then, it was just playing those war games.
Yeah.
War games is what they were.
Exactly. I remember. And tomorrow morning, we bivouac at 0600 hours.
Yeah, right.
Why are we bivouacking?
At 0600 hours.
We want to sleep. We will bivouac at 0600. Why don't we bivouac at 1200,
We were on maneuvers one time, and we had this second lieutenant who was guiding us. He was riding around up in the front of the column. And this was the whole service.
Was he sitting very erect the second?
Oh, yes. Oh, certainly. And he had this little, what they call piscutters, and they were a little hat on.
Yeah.
And so we were riding.
It's a flight cap.
This column, what was all of the service battery is a battery that services all of the other the batteries, the firing battery. We had all the shells. We had all the food. We had everything.
everything. And without us, they stand still.
Right? That's right.
And so here we were driving down this this lane in Germany, and all of a sudden the umpires, you know, this group of generals and colonels go flying by. And we're at the end of the column, and we come and he stops. Tells everybody to stop, and we stop. And he comes over to the car. I went over to see him. Yes, sir. He said, tell that lieutenant to get down here immediately. So I went back. Hello, lieutenant. There's a general back here. Would like to see you immediately. And he says, yes. And his jeep comes buzzing down there. And the general gets out of the car. And the lieutenant gets out of the car and salutes him very snappily. And the general says, what are you doing here? He says, keeping the Russians out of Western Europe, sir. That was the edict that was handed down by the commanding general of the 2nd Armored Division. Anybody who asks you what you're doing here in Germany, tell them you're keeping the Russians out of Western Europe.
Right.
And that broke us. You could just see everybody. The whole column was just shaking with laughter.
Can you believe, I mean, we talk about the military and the American defense team, but, I mean, I've been a part of some absolutely ridiculous situations, that come up in terms of ordinary service. I was never shot at, thank God. But what guys go through and what we put up with in terms of nonsense in the name of military service. I mean, that's a very, very funny story. Oh, but I might say that during that man's term of service, when I was in 62, our job was to keep the Russian missiles from not coming here from Cuba. I did good, didn't I?
No, you did
not,
best.
Not
you
one got us.
No, not you here. Had a lot of excitement during that time.
Did we ever? Yeah. It got a little wild, let me tell you.
Oh, boy. You know, I didn't realize that it was so dangerous. When all that was happening, I was making a film. I was in Spain. And when you're making a film, there's nothing else that seems to have any credence at all except this little cocoon of energy that you're working around, and you're manifesting this thing that's going to exist. And we kept hearing this thing, the crisis is happening, and there could be it. And, really? Mm-hmm. What's the next take? Page 60. And you're into that thing. And it seems really to hear about it now, because there's been a lot of, you know,
when you look back with 2020 and realize here were Khrushchev and Kennedy daring, I dare you to launch one.
Yeah, right.
What are you, nuts?
Yeah. Jeez. You think, wow, I really missed out on that one.
Yeah. You know, there's a picture out with Williams, Good Morning Vietnam.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a lot of moments in that picture, but the one I love is when the guy looks at the when the general looks at the guy, the young shave-tailed lieutenant who wants to be saluted, who takes it so seriously, and he says, remember, it's only radio.
Right.
Hey, I say that to myself every day. It's only radio, or it's only a television show. It's not people getting killed.
Right.
My guest is James Colburn. I'm going to open the lines to all America at 1-800-248-0852. We are back on the air with James Colburn, and here is Kate, who joins us tonight from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hi, Kate, you're on the air.
Gosh, I'm first.
Yes, you are.
Oh, I'm so excited.
If you keep talking, you'll also be last. It's only a joke, Kate.
Oh, okay. I'm really excited about the fact that you're doing The Mists of Avalon, because I gave it to my grandmother for Christmas, and I can't wait to get my hands on it when she's done with it.
Oh, it's a great book.
Well, that's what I hear from a lot of people. How many nights do you think it's going to take place, and why aren't you doing it as a feature film instead?
Well, because it's too big of a book. There's too much there. We considered doing it as a film, but a film would be limited to maybe two and a half hours. And there's more story there than 2.5 hours. So we've cut a lot out of it, and we made it 4 hours. So it'll be, I don't know, either two hours or four hours or, you know, however they break it up.
Uh-huh.
And that's comfortable. That's manageable. Yeah. You know, War and Remembrance, as good as it was, that's a big commitment to make 18 hours of viewing. That's a big commitment for a person to make,
I'll say,
Well, I'll have to get VCR to watch it.
I hope so.
All right, Katie, thank you.
Yeah, I've got to get back to work.
What do you do?
I'm a keyliner for a typesetting firm, and I've got a piece of film drying in the darkroom right now, so I've got to get back to
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye. Here's Leo in Franklin, North Carolina. Hi, Leo, you're on.
Hi. And your role is Flint Colburn?
Yeah.
I heard that you and Troy Reynolds are currently working on another Flint movie. Is there any truth to that?
No. Not at all, no. Everybody that made the Flint movies are dead. I mean, my stuntman who did all the wonderful action is dead. The art director, the guy who wrote it. The only persons that are alive, actually, are Saul David and myself. Saul David was the producer. Of, and really, he was the guiding light behind the Flint series, or the two that we made.
I wonder how many people go around this town and say, yeah, I was talking with Colburn the other day.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, it's fun funny, tomorrow I'll be the only one that's right.
Yeah, right. we actually had a couple of opportunities to put something like that together, but it the thing we would do now, we would probably do now, is something like The Sons of Flint, because he had all of these ladies that were all over the world.
Right.
And so probably we have several sons and daughters around, so that might be a possibility. But as far as me going out there and swinging again, I doubt it.
Man says Schlitz light. That's it. We're coming up on 45 past the hour with James Colburn on the Tuesday night radio show, and here is Jim in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Jim. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Yes, sir.
I've seen all of Mr. Colburn's movies on Our Man Flint, and I love them.
They're terrific pictures.
They were great.
Terrific
and
pictures.
All of these kind of science fiction things too. You know, with Stanley Kubrick's effects, they're great. So I'm gonna go bend over backwards to see that type of flick he's got if I have to go someplace in Canada to see it.
Well, maybe you can, you know, escape a war sometime. I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh, I've got a war story.
Yeah, okay.
I was stationed in Zweibrück in Germany.
Zweibrück?
Yes. For a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And I had those maneuvers also.
Yeah.
And the one that really got me, and there was, nobody was laughing after this, was when they built the Berlin Wall. Oh, we went out on a 10-day alert. We went to a different staging area. And when we arrived there, we knew it was different, and but we were still, you know, joking and everything, until we seen the ammo train pull in at the tail end of the convoy. And when that pulled in with the nuclear rounds, I thought, oh, my God. This is different.
I'll bet.
They're cold sweat.
Yeah. They're not kidding, are they?
They weren't. When you say you're going to try to stop the Russians, that was our thing, too. We were supposed to stop them at the Rhine. And we had a 100-mile missile, of a 100-mile range.
Yep.
And when we saw that ammo train with those special little triangles on the sides, and I was in the forward warhead missileman, my job was to put the firing mission in and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were going to put the live ones on, I thought, oh my gosh.
Yeah, well. So we didn't have any missiles when I was over there. We had 105 howitzers. That was the biggest thing we had.
I was with a corporal unit. You probably remember or seen some of those around.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and a 2nd Missile Battalion for the artillery.
Jim, thanks for joining us tonight, young man.
Yeah, okay, thanks, and it's been nice to talk to you.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye now. When you finished with the war, you went back to New York for a time with your military service. And
yeah.
Is that when you were with Stella Adler? You did television commercials back there, as I recall.
Yeah, I did. I did a Remington Rand shaving commercial, paid for my whole existence in New York. I paid for all my schooling and everything.
Liked it so much, he bought the whole company.
Yeah, right. I should have. Yeah, I used to, Dick Stark used to be the announcer for when they did What's My Line, and occasionally would have me come on there with, you know, showing this demonstration that I did. I shaved my beard off in under a minute, which was some kind of record or something, and so they always had me on there once in a while, and I kept calling them. Yes, I use the Remington Rand shaver. I mean the razor, and he says shaver. I said, yes, shaver. I would call it a razor.
You weren't allowed though to call it a razor.
No, it was an electric shaver.
Yeah.
And of course, you know,
shaver.
I mean, shaver, of course.
Yeah. Shaves as close a blade, I'll give you your money back.
Yeah.
Like it so much, I bought the whole company. He ought to take himself off those commercials.
He's
got a very nice product, but he ought to get off those commercials. Here's Brian in Encino, California. Hi, Brian. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Tom. I got a question for Jim. Jim, I understand you were working on a film project with the late, great Bruce Lee before he died, and you're also a student of this. Can you tell me what impact Bruce Lee had on you?
Oh, well, he was, you know, he was a true master. He was a master martial artist, a true artist. There aren't many of those guys. I mean, you see a lot of people who know a lot about martial arts, but they don't know about being a martial artist.
Or they'll be a karate expert.
Yeah.
Who's very good at karate, but is not a martial artist.
Yeah, no, Bruce created himself, and he created a form called Jeet Kune Do. He was probably the fastest human. You couldn't touch him if he didn't want to be touched. He was a great deal of fun. I loved him a lot, and I miss him. I miss him very badly.
What impact do you think, if he was still around today, where would he be right now? I mean, as far as in motion pictures and martial arts.
Well, I mean,
if we had James Coburn here, he'd be on the phone from somewhere talking to him.
You know, if he were on, he would be. I don't know. It's hard to say, but I think he'd probably continue to be who he was. You know, he just kept getting more and more who he was. I really couldn't say.
He may well have been on a level where he would have gone probably to the most prestigious meetings in the world. With demonstrations of martial arts, and maybe have written some philosophical works on it, beyond entertainment, but and more of almost into a professorship, if you will.
Yeah, he could have done that. He probably
been
because
paid more than Sylvester Stallone's currently being paid.
Possibly, mm-hmm. possibly. But Bruce's talent was a different kind of talent. He wasn't a very good actor, but he was a. He was a genius when it came to movement, and he knew the interior of a combat, and that's something that very few people know, that the inside of, mm-hmm. of what happens between two people when they are in combat. We used to practice this a lot. It's more of a mind game.
Surely.
Than it is anything, because you can come to, the two people can come to each other, and you don't have to fight. You know immediately, you know, why shed any blood? We know who's going to win, right?
Right, right.
You bow and walk away. Bruce was a genius, and I'm sorry he didn't get a chance to really live his life out, but he changed the whole face of martial arts. He gave it a Kung Fu, especially. He gave it a...
You say he wasn't that great an actor, and I think you're right.
Yeah, no, he wasn't an actor. He didn't really... He knew how to play an action, but he played this arch. You know, most Orientals have a kind of archness about them in their acting anyway, because I used to say, Bruce, come on, let me show you some things. Yeah, and he said, no, this is for Southeast Asia. Yeah. He's different from Southeast Asia only. He was a good teacher, too. I mean, he taught me a lot of things.
You know,
he gave each of his tools.
Years ago, I went back to Hong Kong and talked with a guy there named Run Run Shaw.
Run Run Shaw, yeah. He was after Bruce, but...
Yeah, it never happened.
No, but the other guy got him.
Yeah, but this
Raymond
was...
Raymond Chow.
Yeah, but what a big operation, Run Run Shaw in Hong Kong. I mean, turned out like hundreds of motion pictures a year.
Oh, yeah.
More than any of the great Hollywood showmakers back in the 30s, Run Run Shaw. And this was in the 70s and 80s. Run Run Shaw was making lots of movies in Hong Kong. And I don't want it because I don't know what to do with it when I get it. Here's Tom in Lyle, Illinois. Hello, Thomas. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, sir. Go.
There's a film you didn't mention, which I think would be worthwhile for...
There's a lot I didn't mention, my friend. I've only got an hour's time with the man.
Which is called The President's Analyst.
Yeah, it's a good show. You're right. I didn't mention it.
A memorable film. I'd be interested in hearing anything Mr. Coburn has to say about it. And I'd just like anybody who's interested in Coburn's films to get it video if they can.
It's a good show.
Yeah, I produced the film, actually. I put it together with Ted Flicker, who wrote it, in a five-day period. It was Bob Evans' first film.
Robert Evans.
Yeah, we took it to him, and it was, you know, the time of...
And boy, there's a whatever happened to, huh?
Yeah. Well, he's still out there kicking.
Yeah, I know he is.
And he'll be making some more films. He's, you know, he's a tenacious guy, strange guy, but he's good. But The President's Analyst, it struck me because it was because of the nature of the character.
Let's do a movie called Robert Evans' Analyst.
Yeah, right.
You talk about a guy who needs some analysis.
He probably has a couple.
Yes, he does.
Yeah. But he treated us very well at the time, and we got it on in 5 days. I took it to him, and 5 days later we had a deal. Now, that's the fastest time I've ever heard of a film being put together. And, I liked it. It strangely was, I thought we were a little late with it, but actually we were a little before the time of the thing. It was strange. We tried to incorporate all of the current Vogue and, everybody in it.
It's a good show. It's a very good
show. I enjoyed it. It was fun making. I mean, was there any particular question that you had about it?
No, he just wants liner notes.
Oh, I see.
Thank you, Tom.
You're welcome.
Okay. Pleasure to have you on the air. Thank you, Tom. It's been my pleasure being on your show. That's okay.
Yeah.
There's Jim in Toledo, Ohio. Hi, Jim. You're last on. Go ahead.
Good evening. How you doing?
I'm okay, thanks. How are you?
Great.
Good.
I just had a real quick question. The other night, one of the local TV stations had on the movie Magnificent Seven.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you consider the cast and when you consider the script and everything, I personally really found that to be one of the best westerns I had ever seen.
Oh, it's a benchmark movie.
What's that?
That's a benchmark movie, landmark movie.
Yeah, I was just wondering what Jim thought about
that. Up there with Longest Day and The Great Escape and all the great features of this century.
Yeah, I know. The Magnificent Seven was a
What was that? Sturgis did that film?
Sturgis, yeah, John Sturgis. But, I mean, we had a great cast and a great script adapted from a great film by Kurosawa. The Seven Samurai. If nobody's seen that, that's a fantastic film. I just read it was currently out on video now, the 3-hour and 20-minute version, which is brilliant, brilliant.
Film. I haven't seen that. It's good, huh? Are you a video? Do you watch a lot?
No, I really don't. I get these magazines though. AFI sends the magazine, and in the magazine they always have the good films, and they have a review of the films, and there's a whole group of Kurosawa films.